Pete did a good job yesterday in here, helping me moving along. There was a lot to cover, so I was not envious of the amount of chapters that he had to do, but he did a really, really good job. Just looking back on 13 to tie a bow on that, the parables, you'll remember 12, if Matthew was a movie, okay, it would have had an introduction and character development right away in probably 1 through 4. And then you see this rising tension after his Sermon on the Mount, okay? And then in 12, it's going to go down like this and have a resolution. You know that's how any good story works, right? So you have an introduction, character development, problem or tension, and then you have resolution, and then you wrap it up or you give maybe... after it's resolved, what future life is like. I mean, isn't that pretty much every story you've ever seen in the movie somewhere? Some of them have lots of different high points and different things. But chapter 12 in Matthew, that's it. When the persecution reaches its highest and he kind of gets, in a sense, he moves on. He moves on and says, all right, I'm going to start doing something differently. We said in the very beginning on the first day he's going to move from the synagogues to the streets. And he does that by going and teaching in parables. A simple definition for parable is truth thrown alongside. So there's truth in the story. There's truth alongside the story. Not every parables are not meant to be too complicated and not meant to be too simple. Those are you don't want to go in either of those extremes. You don't want to be like, I look into this and I see several layers of inception, of realities we never knew. They're for a purpose. They are illustrating something. Almost every parable is about the kingdom, especially here in 13. And part of what you do in parables is find where you are. That's why it was said to a commoner in common language, so that they could understand either the concept he was describing or where they fit in. Does that make sense? Most of 13 has to deal with the kingdom. So God's ultimate reign, which we know is this, right? A good definition for the kingdom of God, the kingdom of heaven. They can go together in different ways. The kingdom of God is his ruling through Jesus. The kingdom of heaven is what they're anticipating, that spiritual realm too, but sometimes they're interchanged. If you want a good definition, God's people... in God's place, under God's rule. And we say to that, at least with our hermeneutic of grammatical, literal, historical, and even in its biblical context, when we start looking throughout scriptures, not just in Matthew, I can make a theology for you right here about the kingdom and how we should live. There are theologies out there that say kingdom living is to be fully experienced in this life, and I would just disagree. And that's a little bit about that song. You know, you wonder if you wrestle through it. So build your kingdom here. Okay, yeah, I think, yeah, he is. He definitely is in the hearts of people in our spiritual realm, and that gets manifested physically in different ways. But I also read the end of the book when everything's going away, including its people. And everything gets burned up, everything gets destroyed, and there's a new heaven and a new earth. That's coming. A full and final kingdom someday. So I don't want to burst your bubble. I want us to always be moving towards experiencing the most God has in this wretched, destroyed place that is being redeemed in some ways, but redeemed for a time. It's always going to be a mess. We're always going to have work to do this side of us dying or him coming back to get us. Always. And so he's talking about how this kingdom's going to... Did you hear Pete yesterday say break forth? Think of it like in the movies where you've seen a dam break or something. It's like... you know, and you're like, oh, it's coming. And then it crumbles and comes breaking forth. That's the idea of Jesus here in the kingdom of heaven in Matthew. So you have a parable of a sower... that is a lot about the condition of the soil. Everybody understood farming. The seed went everywhere. The gospel that was spread went everywhere, but there's four different types. You see him explain the purpose of parables, and so a lot of times we have definitions by Jesus himself and what it is. So when we look at how he defined in 18 and following the parable of the sower, we understand how to maybe interpret the rest of them. The parable of the weeds says that there's going to be this combined goodness and evil, but at the harvest they're going to be separated, so there's a judgment to the side of the kingdom. The mustard seed, it's going to start small. Prophecy in the parables, we'll get into that down the road. He explains the weeds, the hidden treasure. It just has a lot of value, and you got to look for it. The parable of the net, again, judgment, that it's going to be a separation of what goes on. And he says, have you not understood all these things? And they say in verse 51, yes. Therefore, every scribe who has been trained for the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who brings out his treasure to what is new and what is old. There's something new going on here, and it's opposed to this Jewish idea. The audience is Jewish people, and so when they hear these kinds of things, it's really, really pushing on this external, outward conformity, inward yuck kind of thing. And he's rejected for it. Look at verse 53. When Jesus had finished these parables, he went away from there. Coming to his hometown, he taught them in their synagogue, so that they were astonished and said, where did the man get this wisdom and these mighty works? Because he's doing those as well. Isn't he just this guy from Mary, brother of this and this and this? Aren't they all the whatever? And he took offense in them, but Jesus said, a prophet is not without honor except in his hometown and in his own household. And he did not do mighty works there because of their unbelief. That, go think about that throughout your day, that last part of 13. And the relation between unbelief and what Jesus does or doesn't do, specifically there in that time. Now, we're grateful for what he's done once and fully and finally, and that changes the game for us on this side of the cross. But at that point, at that time, there was a withholding because of their hardness of heart and really their unbelief. So we get to chapter 14. Okay, chapter 14, let's see here. Will, why don't you read 1 through 8. Watch out for these kind of ladies, fellas. Don't get you one of these girls.
At the time of Herod, Tetrarch, heard the reports about Jesus, he said to his servants, this is John the Baptist. He is risen from the dead, and therefore his powers are at work in him. For Herod had laid a hold of John and bound him and put him in prison for the sake of the Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because John had said to him, it is not lawful for you to have her. And although he wanted to put him to death, he feared the multitude because they had counted him as a prophet. But when Herod's birthday came, But when Herod's birthday was celebrated, the daughter of Herodias danced before Herod and pleased Herod. Therefore, he promised with an oath to give her whatever she asked.
Right there. Hold. So Herod the Tetrarch is not Herod who killed babies when Jesus fled. Okay? That's a different. That was his daddy. Herod the Tetrarch, why he's called a Tetrarch, rules a fourth of Palestine. And his dominion, or where he resides, is in Caesarea Philippi, which we're going to get to here in a little bit in chapter 16. John the Baptist is not the guy who wrote John the Gospel, 1, 2, 3 John, and Revelation. Okay, that's a disciple, John. This is John the Baptist, the baptizer, not the Baptist denomination, but the one who was identifying people with the repentance of sin into the expected kingdom to come. That's the guy that's in jail now. And he called out this guy because he said, you're sleeping with your brother's wife, which is just weird. But in that culture, as you'll see, especially in Caesarea Philippi, weird was normal and gross was the bar. Okay? And he gets, and yes, this means what you think it means. He gets his daughter to dance, probably 12 to 14, to dance. Just like what you're thinking and wishing you weren't thinking it this early in the morning. To dance before him, and it pleased him. And so he's like, what do you want? Which is just think about the grossness of that right now. Hey, that's like dirty old man sitting there watching his daughter. Hey, what do you want? I'll give you anything. That dance really made me happy. And it's not like a performance where you go watch your daughter in a little tutu spinning around. Okay? It's gross. That's what it is. And he says, all right, I'll give you what you want. Will, keep reading.
So she, having been prompted by her mother, said, give me John the Baptist's head on a platter. And the king was sorry, nevertheless, because of the oath, and because of those who sat with him, he commanded it to be given to her. So he sent and had John beheaded in prison. And his head was brought on a platter and was given to the girl, and she brought it to her mother. Then the disciples came and took away the body and buried it, and told Jesus.
They gave it a proper burial. Just in case you thought you had a dysfunctional family, be encouraged. There's worse families out there. What does that tell you about the relationship between daughter and mother? That's evil. This is pure evil at this point that is going on. And this guy's head gets cut off, brought on a platter as like a display. Probably a food tray with a lid on it. Here you go, Mom. I got you what you wanted, what you told me to get. Mama knew how to get to Daddy's heart or belly or whatever. Hey, why don't you go dance for your dad and see if he'll give you something. Ask him. Say, Daddy, can I have some? You know, I don't know how it played out, but you got to think it's something close to that. And that's where we're at. So John the Baptist dies. Okay? Now, is there a response of Jesus? Absolutely. Verse 13, when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. He goes to grieve. And the crowds know that he's getting away. They followed him on foot from the towns. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd and had compassion on them and healed their sick. How much courage does it take, and you're in the middle of grieving a loss of a friend, to go be about other people? It takes a lot of mental energy, a lot of courage, doesn't it? What an example there of the kind of person Jesus is. Even if you deny all the other things he's done to this point, knowing that he's probably in an official stage of mourning and still having compassion towards other people shows you how big his heart is and shows you a characteristic of Jesus that I think is profound. So he's doing this now all day, compassion on them and healing them. When it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, this is a desolate place. The day is now over. Send the crowds away to go into the villages and buy food for themselves. Get them out of here. But Jesus said, they need not go away. You give them something to eat. What's in the mind of the disciples right now? Basic observations here. Yeah, we're out in the middle of nowhere, and there's no 7-Eleven around. There's no Mickey D's we can drive through. No $5 pizzas. Send him away. It's late. I'm tired. I'm done. I've had my ministry job check for the day. Camp was good today, but they need to go home. And he says, they don't need to go away. You give them something to eat. What's Jesus doing? Say it again. Maybe not testing. I mean, I think we're entering a preparation stage. Okay, he's definitely going to start to prepare them. He's a really good teacher, Jesus is. When I tell you, hey, Janelle, I want you right now in this room. You can't go into the kitchen. You can't go in the sanctuary. Right now, I want you to feed everybody. What are you thinking? Did Peggy bring anything? That's what you're thinking. You're doubting, you're wondering, like, you're probably be like, you don't want to hurt his feelings, but you almost are like, I think he might be a little stupid right now because he doesn't understand. You know how that emotion is? But he's helping them realize right away, you're not going to be able to do this. As a parent, you'll find this out someday, that you'll ask these kind of questions or demand these kind of things so that your children will think that they can do something. And then realize the bigger point of the story. Okay? You give them something to eat. They said to them in their brilliance, we have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish. Unleavened bread, small loaves, not Subway 12 inchers. Okay? Fish, think sardines. This is not a
couple salmons that they caught from the Sea of Galilee, just waiting to get broiled up. And he said, bring them here to me. So he's saying, you're inadequate, in a sense. I'm raising that to you. They identify all that they have, which is meager. And he's saying, bring me your meager things. Then he ordered the crowds to sit down on the grass, and taking the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing. You see from verse 21, there's 5,000 men besides women and children. So we often call it the feeding of the 5,000. Do you know what the estimate is on the number of people here at this point? 15,000 to 20,000 people, depending on your family dynamics. And if there were any servants there and stuff like that. But the men were labeled 5,000. So you're looking at 15,000 to 20,000. That's Save Mart Center, people. Does anybody know the attendance capacity in Save Mart? I can't imagine it being more than 20. I mean, 10 to 15 maybe, I don't know. That's what we're dealing with. He says a blessing, he broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. So the first time, they're probably like, okay, it's as they have to keep coming back. You got to realize, how long does it take to feed 15,000 people? At some point, you probably go through all the emotions of like, okay. Okay, you probably go through the roller coaster of that thing, you know, and you get done when you're already tired. And it's interesting how much, what was it? Let me see here down the road. I think it's coming. Where's my mouse? Thank you. All right, we'll get back to that then. And they were all ate and were satisfied, and they took up 12 baskets full of broken pieces to leftover. Why? We really don't know. We really don't know why 12 baskets. But there's a good chance you can just associate it with the 12 guys who said, what are we going to do? Send them away. We don't have anything. We only have our little lunch here, right? And he's like, okay, guess what? I am not only going to provide through you for all these people, but I'm going to give you what you need as well. Okay, there's a lot of imagery there in that feeding of the 5,000. Eric, 22 through 27. So 22, long day of ministry, long night of dinner prep. Feeding a room of 20 takes a good amount of time. A simple meal for 15,000 takes a great deal of time. It says right afterwards, it says get in a boat and go. Go to the other side. Which as fishermen, they probably understood, that's weird. Why would I travel at night? It's really hard to drive a boat at night. Unless the moon's out, you know. There's a good moon or whatever, but they're good, obedient people to go to the other side, to get away from the crowds probably. Jesus, where does he go? He goes up to a mountain to pray. That's interesting. I'd want to go home and go to sleep, or I'd want to go home and turn on mindless Sports Center and watch that at the over and over and over and over and see the same highlights 3 or 4 times and then fall asleep. That's what I'd want to do. But this guy goes up to a mountain to pray. When evening came, he was there alone, but the boat was a long way away, beaten by the waves and the wind. So one of those storms comes up that we talked about that can come up so easily. We've already seen one of those at this time. fourth watch of the night, that's between 3 and 6 a.m. What are you doing as a disciple between 3 and 6 a.m. in a boat across the sea? Probably nodding off. Probably focused trying to get where you're going, but you're mentally, you're not real sharp. So don't be surprised when they see something, they're like, ah, it's a ghost. Okay, that's not because they're dumb, it's because they're super tired and it's late at night. Hey, it's I, don't be afraid. Do you think Jesus knew what he was doing to send them away on the boat and go up to the mountain? Do you see this category that we call preparation already starting to happen in the first two things? I'm going to provide for you. In John, there are eight great I am statements. Do you know what one of those I am statements are that refer to something crusty and doughy that you bake? I'm the bread of life. I am going to be the sustenance that you need and the sustenance that the world needs, really. And so he's started to show that there. He's now over nature because he is coming out on the water. That means he's walking on water. There's only two people in all your Bible that have ever done that. Jesus and Peter does for a little bit, which we'll see. Patrick, 28 and following. Hold right there. Gotta love Peter. Oh, I want to do that. I want to come out there. Why would he want to get out of the boat? Why would he? There's a part of Peter that I think sees. I love Peter because I think he's like me and maybe like you a lot of times. He's like, I want to do this really awesome thing. And oh, I'm never, no way. Oh, I really want to do this. No, it can't ever happen. You just see that in Peter, like schizophrenic almost, of just all the places. He's like, I want to come out there. Lord, come on. He's like, come on. And he does. He steps out. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. So when he got distracted and felt the wind too, because do you see the wind? Maybe if it's blowing leaves and stuff, or dirt, you can see it. You ever seen those little dust tornadoes come up? I don't know how they do that. That is so cool to me when I see it. I'm like, wow, it's like a little tornado. Okay. He's afraid and beginning to sink. He goes down, save me. Reach out his hand, so that means he was close enough to get him, and says, you of little faith, why did you doubt? Again, preparation. You saw me in the middle of the night walking on the stinking Sea of Galilee. What more do you need? But we still wrestle, don't we? Even when we see the things that God's done in our life, even when we see him go above and beyond what we even think he could do, and we still like, I don't know, it's like, it's a sea. Like it's wet and I might fall down. He's walking on it. You know, it's really hard to get to that place of absolute confidence with the Lord. And if you find yourself there wrestling and wondering, be encouraged. You could be a disciple. You're good enough to be in the club that Jesus used. Okay. Then they get in the boat and rightly respond, you know what? Truly, you're the Son of a God. Good job, people. Good recognition. He's walking on water. He just fed a stinking grip of people on the mountains. You guys are getting it. He's sharp. All right. Janelle, 34 and through 36. Great job. I didn't know if you were asking a question when you pronounced that or making a statement. Goodness, a rat. Gesundheit. think of this. This is a really tough question. It won't be on your test, but it's for those who are super alert and maybe the super observant. What are three consistent things you see from people, Jesus, or the disciples in these three experiences? Things that happen with their body. No. I don't know how to ask this in a way without giving it away. But there's something that happens in three of these, either from the people who receive the food, Peter, and then what these folks are doing in the Gennesaret. Huh? Touching. Faith faith becomes tangible at some point. Do you think their faith was encouraged when they touched the crust of the bread? When they touched that slimy little fish for dinner? Do you think Peter's faith was encouraged when he grabbed Jesus' hand? He had seen by faith something that became a reality. So much so these people are not, they don't even want a touch from him. They just want to touch him. Because we all long for that versus this ethereal, like, God, I know you're there, and okay, go before me today. It's like there's something to our faith becomes tangible when we help somebody and give them something in need. And we can be, not Jesus for them, but be little J Jesuses of being filled with the big J Jesus, helping them out. And when you see marriages reconciled and you see couples come in and sit with you on either side of the room and they're like, she's stupid. Wow, he's dumb, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And then over time and their hearts breaking, their own laying down a thing, you see them move back together. And then at some point you'll see a hand go over. I mean, that's when their faith in what they think is working in their marriage becomes a reality. I just thought that was interesting as you look through here, that there's something tangible that can come with our faith too that we get to experience here in Jesus. And all of them got, I mean, imagine you're starving, you've watched this guy all day, you've seen him heal, and then you get food that was literally created from nothing. I don't know if it was like broken. Hell, I'm just still breaking it. Check that out. Oh, more loaves, you know. Something came out of nothing in that feeding. And there's a hand that feels familiar, probably calloused, probably. Any of you have been in a long-term relationship where you could probably identify grabbing somebody's hand if your eyes were closed? Like, I promise you, if one of you ladies come up here and gave me your hand as I had a blindfold and my wife gave me her hand, I'd know instantaneously which one was hers. Because I've held her hand a billion times. A billion times. Every day, sit on the couch, grab her hand, in the car, always grab her hand, walking down the street or whatever. It's just so familiar. I think Peter experienced some of that too. Of just when his hand came, goes, there he is. That's the guy I've been looking for. His faith being encouraged. So you see the preparation in all those things right there. He's helping them know that I'm going to be this bread of life for you. I'm going to do things that you're not going to be able to do. I'm going to take your little amount of whatever and I'm going to multiply it. That's the other thing you see here. Whatever you think you have and it's minority, I'm going to make it a majority contribution to the kingdom of God. I can control nature. I can control disease. Boys, I'm worth being trusted in this thing. You don't have to doubt. Are they still going to doubt? All the way up to the cross. They're in the garden. Can't you just stay awake and keep watch? I'm literally about to die, and you guys are snoozing a little bit. Okay, coming. 15. Haley, 15, 1 through 7. You're going to see a huge encouragement towards the disciples and a preparation for them and an absolute street fight start with these religious people. Okay, Pharisees and scribes coming together. Pharisees, what do you think of when you think Pharisees and Sadducees? You think religious parties, polar opposites in some ways, kind of enemies. And scribes, who are they? Lawyers. And the writers, for sure. They write down things, but they're the ones who decide, hey, based on what it said here, I know this so well, let me interpret your decision you need to know based on the word itself, okay? And they, why are your disciples not washing their hands before they eat? That's a really good thing. Do you think in first century Israel, God in his providence knew that germs existed and you needed to wash your hands before you eat? Isn't that a good thing? Before they ever started making public health disclosures? In the 20th century, 21st century. Is science invalidated because of the word of God? No. Do you know in Isaiah, it talks about the world being a sphere, a circle? 2,100 years before Columbus and Magellan figured out, you're not going to fall off if you sail. 2,100 years Isaiah was written before that. Don't tell me science and the Bible don't go together. It's ridiculous. Okay? So they're going to say, why do your disciples do this? They don't wash their hands. And Jesus is going to come back after them. That was a tradition that you wash your hands before you eat, which has been passed down through cultures. Do you grow up in a home still where it's like, I do. I get home, or my boys come in from outside. I'm like, oh, no, you're not sitting down. Go wash your hands. Get rid of all that stuff. But Jesus turns it back on them because that was something that they said was now lawful and binding. He said, how about the honor your mother? How about the fifth commandment? Because it says if you revile them, you should be killed. Yet you and your traditions have created this little piece, even when it comes to inheritance or money that you might have. It's like, when I give it to the Lord, I don't have to honor you. And so he's turning their own silly little traditions that have been created back on them. And he says, you hypocrites, which is a good way to make friends. Just go out to the free speech area today and just start saying, you hypocrites. See how that goes for you. You ever seen anybody that goes out there and does that? Is that a really good message? Do people just come by 15, 20,000, sit with him and want to hang out? No. Everybody's like, bozo. Or you want to... I had that guy in college too. Fresno State's not the only place with a free speech area. It's not the only time. You can go back to the 60s and 70s, and I promise you the free speech area was very different. Okay? You want to start doing the history tapes. We had a guy that later I heard, and it was probably either rumor or like really, really smart, that he was a sociology student and he was doing an experiment, and he turned into this soapbox preacher guy to see an experiment. It was his data for his project. I was like, if you did that, dude, you're genius. And you're going to move on and go everywhere else. I said, you're genius. Or you could just be a turd, like, because that's what he was most of the time. He'd get out there and be like, short shorts, you're going to hell, right? Your hair's braided or whatever. And he'd just start going crazy and he'd yell at people. I remember I'd listen to him at times because I was a Christian and I was walking with the Lord and I understood my Bible enough to get me in trouble. But I also knew in the discernment in my spirit that this guy was a bozo. And then he finished his little time and literally he would turn into this like Hulk. Rah, 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 and then he'd just get his briefcase, go check out of the little student center and write his name out. And he wasn't that way. And so I waited for him. I walked up and I was like, dude, what are you doing here? He's like, I'm sharing a message that needs to be heard. I was like, do you think anybody's listening? Do you think anybody's listening with that? Because I'll tell you what everybody's saying about you as you walk away. And I want, dude, if we are about the Bible and you're about Jesus, we're about the same thing. But I think your strategy is awful. We had a good little conversation in the Oklahoma State Student Union, just sitting at the little before his checkout desk. I was just like, and I want to believe it wasn't true about the sociology experiment because he had this smirk on his face. And he wasn't really trying to be defensive, like, I'm going to do this. It's just like, oh, I understand, But I was just like, that's so weird. But I just wanted to talk to him. And here's Jesus now saying, hypocrites, to these people that are coming, like, you're phonies, you're fakes. Isaiah did prophesy of you. You people, the religious establishment, they honor me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. Outward conformity versus inward transformation. That's what he pushes on with the religious people. And he's going to go on to explain that difference in a tangible way. And if you never thought the Bible had poop jokes, it does. So let's choose a dude to read this. Who wants to read this one? Yeah, Stephen! 10 and following. Good job, boys. Good job. You're really smart. You're getting it. Hey, when you called them hypocrites, they didn't like it. Very observant. Keep reading. He is, that's not nice language. To be sick in that culture meant there was something wrong with you, that you had a sin in your life. And yet the illustration you get in most of Matthew with these powerful things is he's doing ministry to those who can't see, to those who can't walk, to those who can't live, and he's bringing life to their inadequacies and saying, you are the blind people. Do you see that illustration now over and over, that he's going to call the religious people blind, lame, mute? You don't understand. And to the literal blind, lame, and mute, he's going to give life. Because he's a circus guy? No. Because he's showing the world, I'm doing something different than any of your behaviors will ever get you. That ultimately is the big 30,000-foot picture, because he starts calling them blind people. And if they're going to lead themselves, they're going to walk into a pit. Almost like I'm done with them, which in some ways he does. Keep reading. There's your poop joke. Okay. This external cleansing does not clean you. The type of cleaning that I'm talking about. Now, lest you all are not discouraged, evil thoughts, murder, adultery, sexual immorality. Why would you have adultery and sexual immorality? Probably because there's difference. There may be an actual act of going to sleep with someone who's not your spouse, and then there's sexual immorality, which is a word that encompasses just about everything. Okay? Theft, false witness, and slander. Now, if I just took those at your definition in your brain right now, how many of you have never done one of those things? No, go ahead. No, really, it's okay. You can admit it. And if somebody were to raise their hand, which no, I'm glad nobody did, because I didn't either, right? That means I've been a part of this list as well. I'd take you back to Matthew 5 through 7 and say, oh, let me reinterpret what some of these mean. If you've ever looked at a woman lustfully, if you've ever looked at someone in their heart and thought, ooh, sexy, whatever, that sounds like romantic fun. If you've ever thought that in your brain, you've committed adultery in your heart. Oh, and if you've ever been angry at anyone, someone cuts you off and you give them the one finger wave, woo-hoo-hoo, you've committed murder in your heart. See, that Sermon on the Mount levels the playing field for everybody. No one can get away. Some of us could argue a lot of those things right now at face value off the list until I take you back to Matthew 5 through 7. And what he's doing is, it's like, listen, out of the heart, out of the basic disposition of who you are, in its totally depraved state. Not everybody, total depravity doesn't mean you're going to do all the worst things all the time and you're going to be Charles Manson. But totally depraved means at the very basic disposition of who you are, you're going to choose these things. You're defiled and you're evil from the very beginning. Thank you, Adam and Eve. Thank you for imputation. Doesn't seem fair, but it's a reality. All of us. These are what defile a person. Not these external things of cleanliness. Not when you say, I'm clean. No, you're not. You know, have you ever been in an experience mentally and emotionally where you just feel dirty? Because you did something wrong? I did. Listen, I'll be super honest with you, okay? There was, when I got to college, I was in this crazy world of like, I don't have to get home at a certain time. And I joined a fraternity, which was a brilliant idea. Mostly because they said, hey, we have really cool parties and we win intramural sports. And I said, well, I like the second one. And parties are, you meet people. I didn't drink. I was one of two guys in my fraternity that didn't drink. So then they started calling me Reverend the first year. Reverend in the fraternity, which was great. And then you look back at your life and you're like, I should have. So I have a lot of shame and guilt there. But there was a time in college that I was like, oh, relationships. Let's just try this out and see how that works. And I was always the guy who wanted to go in his mind and say, I want to be the crazy relational guy and have all those experiences. And then it would get to reality. I'd be like, hey, how's it going? And just scared, right? And wouldn't do anything. And I remember, quote unquote, hooking up with this girl, totally stayed above the equator, just so you know, since we're going to go there in residency. But I remember just feeling like dirty after that. Just having this thing, and like, you just, and I was just like, it was not a, I just remember feeling dirty. And then talking about that, I've had multiple experiences. That's just one. I could do 100 more through college that you've all been there too. And you just get a sense of like, ah, I was like, I just need to go make it right. Like, I need to go do something where I feel clean. Take a shower, go talk to somebody, go sit on it, lay down on a couch and tell some therapist, you know, about what I did and get back to my, in touch with my right energy or whatever. And you, that's what our world goes through. That's what he's trying to set up here. And all of you can identify with that. All of you can identify with having done something, just feeling like, ugh, I need to make it right. Can I just encourage you? The same thing's true for us that's true for them. You're not going to have any religious duty that's going to clean you. So if you're a train wreck and the list of relationships behind you is long and numerous, you won't get clean by taking a shower, taking some shot, whatever. Okay? If you're an angry person who just slanders people and cusses them up and down and is bitter against the world, you're not going to get clean by changing your vocabulary. I'm a comfort eater. When life gets hard, I want to go to Chipotle. I come home from our day work, whatever, this or that. Relationships are crazy. Tension's high. Let's go out to eat. My wife's like, oh, hard day. She knows me now. I'm not going to get clean by starting a new diet. Okay. And changing the things on the outside in. I'm going to get changed by changing my heart, saying, you don't have to go do that. You don't have to satisfy your emotions you can't control by going to do something. Do you see what I'm saying here? This is the type of thing he's raising up with this illustration. It's not what you do on the outside. It's this part inside of you. Food goes in, food comes out. That's what food does. But what starts in here, all those things, that's what makes you unclean. I mean, that's profound thinking in a Jewish culture that for now some thousands of years, particularly the last 600, have said, just do good, monkey. Just be better. Sit up straight. Put your shoulders back. Chin up. Say the right thing. Do the right thing. Don't hang out with those people. Hang out with the people. Don't go to that movie. Don't go to this movie. Don't dance. Don't eat that. Don't wear your hair like that. You're a private garden, not a public park, sweetie. Put your button up your blouse, right? No, no. Do you like that one? That's Schultz told me that one. Schultz told me that one this last week. I was like, oh, did they use that on you? Oh, okay. Schultz tells his girls all the time, like his littlest 4 or 5 year old, that's like had her shirt on, but she only got a few buttons right, and she came up. He's like, public park. Oh, yeah, okay, private garden. Right. So she goes, which I thought was good. Let's keep reading. The tangent, duly understood what Jesus is trying to teach here. Carrie Ann, 21. Faith of a woman here. Let's just go through the little section, 21 through 28. Okay, time out. Sorry. I'm the interrupter. Tyre and Sidon. What's this? A circle. What's that? G, J, G, S. Okay? Israel. He's in this region, and he's going up here. Where are we moving out of? So it's Matthew is written to the Jews. This part is super offensive right here because we're talking about pagan people now. We're not talking about Jewish people. So sometimes you have to understand, even though in the Gospels and the message was for Jewish people, I think Jesus is making a case for how much broader and bigger it's going to be. What's he doing in chapters 14 through 20? What's our P word? We're going to get the heck out of Dodge right now because I just stirred up the religious establishment. I called them hypocrites, told some jokes, really said, you guys can't do it. And so I'm going to go to the coast. I'm out. Right? That's what we're doing. Keep reading, girl. What? A pagan woman saying what? Say it again loud, Carrie Ann. Have mercy. Does Jesus, question, does Jesus not know everything? I know, I put it in there for a reason so you'd think about it. Simpler question, is Jesus omniscient? Well, if he's fully God, then yes. So, is he growing up right here? Is he maturing in his ministry with this Canaanite pagan woman? No. No. And if you have anybody that you sit under at a church that says, look at this, even Jesus needed to grow in his understanding how to reach people, walk out of the church. Leave that place. Who is this story for primarily? This story in particular. Thank you, Paul. It's not about this woman. Does Jesus know exactly what's going to happen? Does Jesus know the words that will come out of her mouth before she says them? Okay, you need to know that about him when you interpret this passage. Because they're all going, get her away, get her away. She's crying after us. Hey, listen, I only came to the house of Israel. Did he? Particularly in the Gospels, yes. But here you're in Canaan. And so he's trying to show an illustration. The disciples are getting annoyed. This lady is absolutely resilient. Help me. She even calls him son of David. How does a Canaanite woman know there's a link to David of the Jewish Old Testament scriptures? Something's going out. Some kind of influence, synagogue there up or whatever. And so he says, hey, is it not right for the children's bread to throw it to the dogs? Is he saying there's a different class of people right here? Or is he using maybe cultural norms, cultural words that she would understand, that she would probably even accept and feel? And then she said, yeah, but these dogs eat crumbs that fall from the master's table. And he says, great is your faith. Here are these disciples that have seen 15,000 people fed, that one of them literally walked on water, the only guy in history besides Jesus to do that, that have watched now countless healings of sick, lame, diseased, paralyzed, crippled people get healed, and they're super annoyed with this Canaanite woman and want to send her away. And now Jesus says, oh, your faith, girl, you get it. Great is your faith, be it done as you desire. Demon-possessed daughter, healed instantly. How's that like for that woman to return home to her daughter? You think her life has changed forever? I want to see what her story's like. Like, I want that documentary to watch following that and beyond. See what it's like. Jesus went on from there and walked beside the Sea of Galilee, went up on a mountain and sat down there. Great crowds came to him, bringing him the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others, and put him at his feet. Jesus' ministry is to the outcast, the lowly, the ones here who don't have a chance. Question. It's an illustration. Stuff in the family and stuff in the pets. Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. It would be a class distinction too. Probably what we feel when we see poor people, right, or homeless people on the street, and we whatever goes through our mind, good, bad, or ugly, and we think that. He's making an illustration from the bread piece. Help me, he says, hey, it's not right that, listen, the family gets it first. Because what he's talking about is it went to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles. He's like, listen, I came to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. That's my family right now. And I'm not going to give the dogs what I'm giving my kids first. The problem is what? Read just a few verses earlier. What did the kids do with daddy's bread? No, we don't want it. You're stirring up our things. Your people don't even wash their hands. And so it's setting up this thing for the disciples to see in an interaction. Jesus says, I'm coming to Israel. They rejected me, by the way. And look, it's going to go out. It's going to spill over to affect all these different people. Does that make sense? That's what the Gospels are, to the Jews first and then the Gentiles. The message came to the Jews. They had a chance. They rejected him and killed him. You're even going to see Paul carries on a gospel of grace. And Jesus has a gospel of the kingdom, if you want to make it of those kind of their concentric circles. Classic dispensationalist will cut off the circles and not overlap and say, God worked here in the garden, here in the law, here with the monarchy. Here in the garden, here with the law, here with the monarchy, here with Jesus, here with the Gentiles, here someday with Israel again, and then here with everybody. And they don't overlap. And you know, and covenant theologians will be like, well, it was Abraham here, and then Noah here, and all these different covenants all the way around. And so you have covenant theology and dispensationalists like this. I'm what's called a progressive dispensationalist. I think they're chains that are linked together, that are all connected. And it's a frustrating yes when you see, is the promise of Abraham still true for the people of God? Yes, because I read Romans 9, 10, 11, and I see a future for Israel. You know, so covenant theologians will say, Israel's the church. There's no future for Israel. It's just the church now. I'm like, man, I read Romans very differently. And you will too when you get to 9, 10, and 11. But this classic version, you know, would say, this thing Jesus talked about, that's no more. His ministry and all that kind of stuff was good, and by way of principle, it's right. But really, what's for us is just the New Testament epistles and Paul. I'm like, I don't know. I mean, yes, I see that break. The language, the dispensational change, all that kind of stuff. And it's about grace, and it does go to the Gentiles. You see that very clearly in Acts multiple times. But I think they're connected. And I think it's one of those frustrating yeses. Is the church Israel and Israel the church? Yeah. Are they different? Yeah. Because I know Jewish people who have put their faith in Jesus, who are now in this thing called the church, where there's a spiritual king in Jesus, ruling and reigning already, but not yet, fully. But I also read in Romans 9, 10, 11, there's something coming. What he's doing here is setting up what's coming with that. And he's preparing them for, I came first to Israel, they said no. And now you're going to see it spill over and affect really everybody, because there are no classes of people. And now I'm spending time, you know, with the lowly primarily, and I'm physically healing that which is a spiritual reality for the Jewish people. Lame, blind, crippled, whatever. Okay? And he heals them to glorify the God of Israel. You see another feeding. It's a different feeding. It's 4,000. And they still have questions. Look at verse 33. Where are we to get enough bread in such a desolate place to feed a crowd? I mean, that's where you face palm right here, fellas. Just insert that. Is what Jesus did, okay? And so he goes through that. They ate and they were satisfied. He, at the end, sending away the crowds, he got in a boat and went to the region of Magadan. Now you get to 16. Where are we at on time? Good, half an hour. Cruising good. Open. I got pictures for you today. Stink. We'll get there in a second. Let's see. Paul. Great question. I don't know. I'd have to go back and look. Sometime. It's not day after day after day. Some time has passed.
So enough time for them to forget what happened, or they just didn't believe?
Boy, I would hope so. I'd like to say, yeah, a little time went by. Because if it was, if that feeding of the 5,000 happened on Sunday, and the next weekend we're feeding 4, we got issues. Teenagers. Sure. 12 to 14. Probably, and this is, I wonder if they were the same age as that girl that was dancing for Herod. I don't think they were there, but I don't know. That's weird to think about. They're kids. They're kids. But kids in that day are different than kids today. 12, 14-year-old today? No, not a chance to do what they did. Youthful. That's a bike gang traveling around Galilee doing some crazy things. Get my slushy, right? Here we go. Let's do some ministry. Matthew is a tax collector. Yeah, probably. I'd have to go back and look. I mean, you'd think he's more established at that point. Some of those fishermen were younger because of it may have been a variety of ages too. That's something I've never really put a bunch of time in, but most of them I've heard that they were young for their life. But let's see here. Where did Jeff? Oh, she's getting coffee. Somebody read 16:1-4. Who comes in first in verse 1? That's the Republican National Convention and the Democratic National Convention locking arms and coming to talk to the independent candidate. What? What are they doing together? Hey, show us something. Do your show, monkey. Show us something. Give us a sign so that we really, really know. What? You can tell the weather. You can look out there on the horizon and see if it's going to be stormy, but you don't even see what's right in front of you. Guess what? Nothing's going to be given to you except the sign of Jonah. Drop the mic, walk away. That's what he does. He literally leaves. Wait a second. The sign of Jonah, like the Old Testament prophet in the whale for 3 days? Yeah. That's what he said. Bounces. When the disciples reached the other side, they had forgotten to bring any bread. Jesus, again, face palm right here. Watch and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Now he's associating a physical image with what those groups, the religious people, are asking. They began discussing it among themselves, saying, we brought no bread. And he's like, it's not about the bread, people. Oh, you of little faith. Why are you discussing among yourselves that the fact that you have no bread? We've been a part of two meals now. Two times. I had a Lunchable and fed Save Mart. Twice. Do you not perceive? Don't you remember the 5 loaves of 5,000? How many baskets? 7 loaves in the 4,000? How do I know they're two different events? Jesus said so. So anybody tells you those are the same events? No, they're not. Because I read my Bible. They're two different things. How is it that you fail to understand that I did not speak about bread? Why is he not speaking about bread? Not talking about what you think you need. I'm talking about something so much more. And watch out for the religious people and the leaven inside of them. What's leaven do, bakers? What's leaven? What's another word for leaven? Yeah, how much of it do you put when you're making a loaf? A teaspoon? A little bit? A sprinkle? Compared to the flour and everything else, it's not that much. But does it affect everything? You better believe it. Permeates the whole loaf so that it rises up. He says, watch out for that. Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of the bread, but the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Woo! Hey, have patience with yourself, because we're these guys, aren't we? We've seen God work so much in our life, and then when stuff hits the fan or whatever, like, what are you doing? Why do you have me here, Lord? I don't even understand. This is so hard. You don't even see. Be encouraged. We're part of that same group. We'd be invited into the bike gang. Slushy. Okay. Now, look at this. Verse 13. This is one of my favorite passages in the whole Bible to teach. He went, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, here's where we are. Take away. Covenant theology. Dispensationalism.
and some trees. It kind of looks like the middle part's okay. Down here is awful. It's rocks everywhere. I've showed you that picture. Up here, solid. Vegetation, waterfalls, rivers, solid. Okay, let's take a look. Oh, I gotta connect again. TV card. Don't believe me that it's beautiful up there? Take a look. That's Caesarea Philippi. Okay? So, you see the mountain and all that kind of stuff? This will make tons of sense as we keep going. As they're going into this place where Herod the Tetrarch lived, dancing daughter, cut off the head, that guy. This was his hometown. Okay? As he's going with who? The disciples. He asks this question. Who do people say that I am? I think we get some different answers if we go to River Park, stand outside all the shops and say, hey, who's Jesus? You think we get different answers? I think if we went to Fresno State today or FPU and said, who's Jesus? You think we, that'd be interesting to see, actually. You think we get different answers? Right. Okay, so he's asking them this question. And being Jewish people, they give a Jewish history kind of understanding from the people they probably run with in verse 14. And they say, some say John the Baptist, reincarnated. Others say Elijah. Others Jeremiah. John the Baptist, some are identifying you with his message. Repent and the Messiah is coming. That message. Some say Elijah. They were looking for him to be reincarnated. The reincarnated Elijah was going to be the Messiah. And others say Jeremiah, just a good prophet who has words. Words to say. And then he asks a very different question. What does he say there in red? First one's pretty safe, isn't it? Everybody's got an opinion. Everybody's got a blog. Everybody's got a Facebook post that'll tell you what they think. Yeah, it's fine. But as soon as you say, but who do you say that I am? Now there's ownership. Now there's responsibility. Now there's something you have to really, you know, kind of come to own. Simon Peter, first to speak. You got to love the guy. You are the Christ. The Son of the Living God. And at that point, Jesus is probably like, super duper. You'll see where it came from in a second. It wasn't just because Peter made the right choice in the right moment. Jesus answered him, blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah. Simon, son of Jonah. Anytime you see that bar, it just means son of. For flesh and blood has not revealed this to you. Who did? Not about having the right answer a lot of times. It's about transforming our mind, conforming our mind to what God thinks. And in this particular moment, hey, the thoughts you had in your brain, Peter, is not because you're a really good brain. It's because my Father in heaven revealed it to you to make this declaration. Okay? You are Peter, and on this rock, I'll build my church. That's good news, isn't it? This is not a passage to make him Pope. Okay, that's been grossly, grossly misinterpreted through history. What he says from his mouth is what Jesus is affirming. The confession of Peter that you're the Christ, the Son of the Living God. You're the one we've been looking for. You're full of deity. You're full of man. You're the Messiah. You're the one. Based on that confession, Jesus says, I'm going to build my church. And then when you understand this place, it takes on a whole new meaning. Because it says they're in other places, they're on a high mountain. Does that look like a rock? You know what Peter's name means? Rock. Cephas to Peter, the rock. It's a play on words. Standing up there, hey, on this rock. Peter rock, this confession rock, this literal rock. Guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to build my church. Now, in Caesarea Philippi, you got to know what was going on at that time.
This is us walking around, so you see closer. There's a cave in here and a spring that bubbles up water. Okay, and these little niches right here are really places they had idols of different things put in there. So this is us walking around. Over here's something really funny. It's the remnant of artifacts in Caesarea Philippi. And when we got there, he had us sit on them, the teacher did. And then he tells us the story of what was going on in Caesarea Philippi, and we quickly got off our seat. You know why? Because he had us sit on this huge, round stone. That was reminiscent. And we're all adults here this morning.